Next morning, at about 10 o'clock, Lord Wellington was sitting at a makeshift desk in the chancel of the ruined church. He looked up and saw Strange entering the church. "Well?" he asked. Strange sighed and said, "Where is Sergeant Nash? I need him to bring out the dead bodies. With your permission, my lord, I will try some magic that I heard of once." Footnote 3. Strange knew of it as a piece of magic done by the Raven King. Most of the king's magic was mysterious, beautiful, subtle, and so it comes as a surprise to us to learn that he should have employed any spell so brutal. In the mid-13th century, several of the king's enemies were attempting to form an alliance against him. Most of its members were known to him. The King of France was one, the King of Scotland another, and there were several disaffected fairies who gave themselves grandiose titles and who may or may not have governed the vast territories they claimed. There were also other personages, more mysterious, but even greater. The king had, for most of his reign, been on good terms with most angels and demons, but now it was rumoured that he had quarrelled with two. Zadkiel, who governs Mercy, and Alrenarch, who governs Shipwreck. The king does not seem to have been greatly worried by the activities of the alliance, but he became more interested when certain magical portents seemed to show that one of his own noblemen had joined with them and was plotting against him. The man he suspected was Robert Barbatus, Earl of Wharfdale, a man so known for his cunning and manipulative ways that he was nicknamed the Fox. In the king's eyes, there was no greater crime than betrayal. When the Fox's eldest son, Henry Barbatus, died of a fever, the Raven King had his body taken out of its grave, and he brought him back to life to tell what he knew. Thomas of Dundale and William Nanchester both had a deep disgust for this particular sort of magic, and pleaded with the king to employ some other means. But the king was bitterly angry, and they could not dissuade him. There were 100 other forms of magic he could have used, but none were so quick or so direct, and like most great magicians, the Raven King was nothing if not practical. It was said that in his fury, the Raven King beat Henry Barbatus. In life, Henry had been a splendid young man, much admired for his handsome face and graceful manners, much feared for his knightly prowess. That such a noble knight should have been reduced to a cowering, whimpering doll by the king's magic made William Lanchester very angry and was the cause of a bitter quarrel between the two of them, which lasted several years. News quickly got about headquarters that the magician was going to do something to the dead Neapolitans. Flores de Avia was a tiny place, scarcely more than 100 dwellings. The previous evening had proved very dull for an army of young men who had just won a great victory, and who felt inclined to celebrate, and it was considered highly probable that Strange's magic would prove the best entertainment of the day. A small crowd of officers and men soon gathered to see it. The church had a stone terrace which overlooked a narrow valley and a prospect of pale, towering mountains. Vineyards and olive groves clothed the slopes. Sergeant Nash and his men fetched the 17 corpses from the bell tower and propped them up in a sitting position against a low wall that marked the edge of the terrace. A Strange walked along, looking at each in turn. "I thought I told you," he said to Sergeant Nash, "that I particularly did not want anyone interfering with the corpses." Sergeant Nash looked indignant. "I'm sure, sir," he said, "that none of our lads has touched them. But my lord," he said, appealing to Lord Wellington, "there was scarcely a corpse on the battlefield that those Spanish irregulars had not done something to." He expatiated on the various national failings of the Spanish and concluded that if a man so much as went to sleep where the Spanish could find him, he would be sorry for it when he woke up. Lord Wellington waved impatiently at the man to make him quiet. "I do not see that they are very much mutilated," he said to Strange. "Does it matter if they are?" Strange muttered blackly that he supposed it did not, except that he had to look at them. Indeed, most of the wounds that the Neapolitans bore appeared to have been the ones that killed them, but all of them had been stripped naked, and several had had their fingers cut off, the better to remove their rings. One had been a handsome young man, but his beauty was very much marred now that someone had plucked out his teeth to make false teeth and cut off most of his black hair to make wigs. Strange told a man to fetch a sharp knife and a clean bandage. When the knife was brought, he took off his coat and rolled up the sleeve of his shirt. Then he began muttering to himself in Latin. He next made a long, deep cut in his arm, and when he had got a good strong spurt of blood, he let it splash over the heads of the corpses, taking care to anoint the eyes, tongue, and nostrils of each. After a moment, the first corpse roused itself. There was a horrible, rasping sound, as its dried-out lungs filled with air, and its limbs shook in a way that was very dreadful to behold. Then, one by one, the corpses revived and began to speak in a guttural language which contained a much higher proportion of screams than any language known to the onlookers. Even Wellington looked a little pale. Only Strange continued, apparently without emotion. "Dear God!" cried Fitzroy Somerset. "What language is that?" "I believe it is one of the dialects of hell," said Strange.
"Is it indeed?" said Somerset. "Well, that is remarkable."
"They have learnt it very quickly," said Lord Wellington. "They have only been dead 3 days."
He approved of people doing things promptly and in a businesslike fashion.
"But do you speak this language?"
he asked Strange.
No, my lord." "Then how are we to talk to them?"
For answer, Strange grasped the head of the first corpse, pulled open its jabbering jaws, and spat inside its mouth. Instantly, it began to speak in its native earthly language, a thick Neapolitan dialect of Italian, which to most people was quite as impenetrable and almost as horrible as the language it had been speaking before. It had the advantage, however, of being perfectly comprehensible to Captain White. With Captain White's help, Major Grant and Colonel Delancey interrogated the dead Neapolitans, and were highly pleased by the answers they returned. Being dead, the Neapolitans were infinitely more anxious to please their questioners than any living informer could have been. It seemed that shortly before their deaths at the Battle of Salamanca, these wretches had each received a secret message from their countrymen hidden in the woods, informing them of the capture of the cannon and telling them to make their way to a village a few leagues north of the city of Salamanca, from where they could easily be able to find the wood by following secret signs chalked on trees and boulders. Major Grant took a small detachment of cavalry, and within a few days he returned with both guns and deserters. Wellington was delighted. Unfortunately, Strange was entirely unable to discover the spell for sending the dead Neapolitans back to their bitter sleep. Footnote 4. To end the lives of the corpses, you cut out their eyes, tongues, and hearts. He made several attempts, but these had very little effect, except that once he made all 17 corpses suddenly shoot up until they were 20 feet tall and strangely transparent, like huge watercolour paintings of themselves down on thin muslin banners. When Strange had returned them to their normal size, the problem of what should be done with them remained. At first, they were placed with the other French prisoners, but the other prisoners protested loudly about being confined with such shambling, shuffling horrors. "And really," observed Lord Wellington, as he eyed the corpses with distaste, "one cannot blame them." So when the prisoners were sent back to England, the dead Neapolitans remained with the army. All that summer, they travelled in a bullock cart, and on Lord Wellington's orders, they were shackled. The shackles were intended to restrict their movements and keep them in one place. But the dead Neapolitans were not afraid of pain. Indeed, they did not seem to feel it. So it was very little trouble to them to extricate themselves from their shackles, sometimes leaving pieces of themselves behind. As soon as they were free, they would go in search of Strange and begin pleading with him in the most pitiful manner imaginable to restore them to the fullness of life. They had seen hell and were not anxious to return there. In Madrid, the Spanish artist Francisco Goya made a sketch in red chalk of Jonathan Strange, surrounded by the dead Neapolitans. In the picture, Strange is seated on the ground. His gaze is cast down, and his arms hang limp at his sides, and his whole attitude speaks of helplessness and despair. The Neapolitans crowd around him. Some are regarding him hungrily, others have expressions of supplication on their faces. One is putting out a tentative finger to stroke the back of his hair. It is, needless to say, quite different from any other portrait of Strange. On the 25th of August, Lord Wellington gave an order for the dead Neapolitans to be destroyed. Footnote 5. Concerning the dead Italian soldiers, I can only say that we greatly regretted such cruelty to men who had already suffered a great deal, but we were obliged to act as we did. They could not be persuaded to leave the magician alone. If they had not killed him, then they would have certainly driven him mad. We were obliged to set two men to watch him while he slept, to keep the dead men from touching him and waking him up. They had been so battered about since their deaths. They were not, poor fellows, a sight anyone wished to see upon waking. In the end, we made a bonfire and threw them on it. Lord Fitzroy Somerset to his brother, the 2nd of September, 1812. Strange was in some anxiety lest Mr. Norrell get to hear of the magic he had done at the ruined church at Flores de Avia. He made no mention of it in his own letters, and he begged Lord Wellington to leave it out of his dispatches.
"Well, very well," said his lordship.
Lord Wellington was not in any case particularly fond of writing about magic. He disliked having to deal with anything he did not understand extremely well.
"But it will do very little good," he pointed out.
"Every man that has written a letter home in the last 5 days will have given his friends a very full account of it."
"I know," said Strange uncomfortably. "But the men always exaggerate what I do, and perhaps by the time people in England have made allowances for the usual embellishments, it will not appear so very remarkable. They will merely imagine that I healed some Neapolitans that were wounded, or something of that sort."
The raising of the 17 dead Neapolitans was a good example of the sort of problem faced by Strange in the latter half of the war. Like the ministers before him, Lord Wellington was becoming more accustomed to using magic to achieve his ends, and he demanded increasingly elaborate spells from his magician. However, unlike the ministers, Wellington had very little time or inclination for listening to long explanations of why a thing was not possible. After all, he regularly demanded the impossible of his engineers, his generals, and his officers, and he saw no reason to make an exception of his magician.
"Find another way," was all he would say,
as Strange tried to explain that such and such a piece of magic had not been attempted since 1302, or that the spell had been lost, or that it had never existed in the first place. As in the early days of his magicianship, before he had met Norrell, Strange was obliged to invent most of the magic he did, working from general principles and half-remembered stories from old books. In the early summer of 1813, Strange again performed a sort of magic the like of which had not been done since the days of the Raven King. He moved a river. It happened like this. The war that summer was going well, and everything Lord Wellington did was crowned with success. However, it so happened that one particular morning in June, the French found themselves in a more advantageous position than had been the case for some time. His lordship and the other generals immediately gathered together to discuss what could be done to correct this highly undesirable situation. Strange was summoned to join them in Lord Wellington's tent. He found them gathered round a table upon which was spread a large map. His lordship was in really excellent spirits that summer, and he greeted Strange almost affectionately.
"Ah, Merlin, there you are. Here is our problem. We are on this side of the river, and the French are on the other side, and it would suit me much better if the positions were reversed."
One of the generals began to explain that if they marched the army west here, and then built a bridge across the river here, and then engaged the French here,
"It will take too long," declared Lord Wellington. "Far too long. Merlin, could not you arrange for the army to grow wings and fly over the French? Could you do that, do you think?"
His lordship was perhaps half joking, but only half.
"It's only a matter of supplying each man with a little pair of wings. Take Captain Macpherson, for example," he said, eyeing an enormous Scotsman. "I have a great fancy to see Macpherson sprout wings and flutter about."
Strange regarded Captain Macpherson thoughtfully.
No, he said at last, "but I would be grateful, my lord, if you would permit me to borrow him and the map for an hour or two."
Strange and Captain Macpherson peered at the map for some time, and then Strange went back to Lord Wellington and said that it would take too long for every man in the army to sprout wings, but it would take no time at all to move the river, and would that do?
"At the moment," said Strange, "the river flows south here and then twists northwards here. If, upon the other hand, it flowed north instead of south and twisted southwards here, then, you see, we would be on the north bank and the French on the south."
"Oh," said his lordship. "Very well."
The new position of the river so baffled the French that several French companies, when ordered to march north, went in entirely the wrong direction, so convinced were they that the direction away from the river must be north. These particular companies were never seen again, and so it was widely supposed that they had been killed by the Spanish guerrilleros. Lord Wellington later remarked cheerfully to General Picton that there was nothing so wearying for troops and horses as constant marching about, and that in future he thought it would be better to keep them all standing still while Mr. Strange moved Spain about like a carpet beneath their feet. Meanwhile, the Spanish Regency Council in Cadiz became rather alarmed at this development and began to wonder whether, when they finally regained their country from the French, they would recognize it. They complained to the Foreign Secretary, which many people thought ungrateful. The Foreign Secretary persuaded Strange to write the Regency Council a letter, promising that after the war he would replace the river in its original position, and also anything else which Lord Wellington required to be moved during the prosecution of the war. Among the many things which Strange moved were a wood of olive trees and pines in Navarra. Footnote 6. Colonel Vickery had reconnoitred the wood and discovered it to be full of French soldiers waiting to shoot at the British army. His officers were just discussing what to do about it when Lord Wellington rode up. "We could go around it, I suppose," said Wellington, "but that will take time, and I'm in a hurry. Where is the magician?" Someone went and fetched Strange. "Mr. Strange," said Lord Wellington, "I can scarcely believe that it will be much trouble to you to move these trees. A great deal less, I am sure, than to make 4,000 men walk 7 miles out of their way. Move the wood, if you please." So Strange did as he was asked, and moved the wood to the opposite side of the valley. The French soldiers were left cowering on a barren hillside, and very quickly surrendered to the British. The city of Pamplona. Footnote 7. Owing to a mistake in Wellington's maps of Spain, the city of Pamplona was not exactly where the British had supposed it to be. Wellington was deeply disappointed when, after the army had marched 20 miles in one day, they did not reach Pamplona, which was discovered to be 10 miles further north. After swift discussion of the problem, it was found to be more convenient to have Mr. Strange move the city rather than change all the maps. And two churches in the town of Saint-Jean-de-Luz in France. Footnote 8. The churches in Saint-Jean-de-Luz were something of an embarrassment, and there was no reason whatsoever to move them. The fact of the matter was that one Sunday morning, Strange was drinking brandy for breakfast at a hotel in Saint-Jean-de-Luz with three captains and two lieutenants of the 16th Light Dragoons. He was explaining to these gentlemen the theory behind the magical transportation of various objects. It was an entirely futile undertaking. They would not have understood him very well had they been sober, and neither they nor Strange had been entirely sober for 2 days. By way of an illustration, Strange swapped the positions of the two churches, with the congregations still inside them. He fully intended to change them round again before the people came out, but shortly afterwards he was called away to a game of billiards, and never thought of it again. Indeed, despite Strange's many assurances, he never found the time or inclination to replace river, wood, city, or indeed anything at all in its original position. On the 6th of April, 1814, the Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte abdicated. It is said that when Lord Wellington was told, he performed a little dance. When Strange heard the news, he laughed aloud, and then suddenly stopped and murmured, "Dear God, what will they do with us now?" It was presumed at the time that this somewhat enigmatic remark referred to the army, but afterwards several people wondered if he might perhaps have been talking about himself and the other magician. The map of Europe was created anew. Bonaparte's new kingdoms were dismantled, and the old ones put back in their places. Some kings were deposed, others were restored to their thrones. The peoples of Europe congratulated themselves on finally vanquishing the great interloper. But to the inhabitants of Great Britain, it suddenly appeared that the war had had an entirely different purpose. It had made Great Britain the greatest nation in the world. In London, Mr. Norrell had the satisfaction of hearing from everyone that magic, his magic and Mr. Strange's, had been of vital importance in achieving this. One evening, towards the end of May, Arabella returned home from a victory dinner at Carlton House. She had heard her husband spoken of in terms of the warmest praise. Toasts had been made in his honour, and the Prince Regent had said a great many complimentary things to her. Now it was just after midnight, and she was sitting in the drawing-room reflecting that all she needed to complete her happiness was her husband home again, when one of the maids burst in and cried out, "Oh, madam,
The master is here.
Someone came into the room. He was a thinner, browner person than she remembered. His hair had more grey in it, and there was a whitish scar above his left eyebrow. The scar was not recent, but she had never seen it before. His features were what they had always been, but somehow his air was different. This scarcely seemed to be the person she had been thinking of only a moment ago. But before she could be disappointed, or awkward, or any of the things she had feared she would be when he at last came home, he looked around the room with a quick, half-ironic glance that she knew in an instant. Then he looked at her with the most familiar smile in the world and said, "I'm home." The next morning, they still had not said 1/100th part of all they had to tell each other. "Sit there," said Strange to Arabella.
"In this chair?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"So that I may look at you. I have not looked at you for 3 years, and I have long felt the lack of it. I must supply the deficiency." She sat down, but after a moment or two, she began to smile.
"Jonathan, I cannot keep my countenance if you stare at me like that. At this rate, you will have supplied the deficiency in 1/2 hour. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but you never did look at me so very often. You always had your nose in some dusty old book."
"Untrue. I had entirely forgotten how quarrelsome you are. Hand me that piece of paper. I shall make a note of it."
"I shall do no such thing," said Arabella, laughing.
"Do you know what my first thought upon waking this morning was? I thought I ought to get up and shave and breakfast before some other fellow servant took all the hot water and all the bread rolls. Then I remembered that all the servants in the house were mine, and all the hot water in the house was mine, and all the bread rolls were mine too. I do not think I was ever so happy in my life."
"Were you never comfortable in Spain?"
"In a war, one is either living like a prince or a vagabond. I have seen Lord Wellington, his grace, I should say."
Footnote 9.
The British government made Lord Wellington a duke. At the same time, there was a great deal of talk of ennobling Strange. "A baronetcy, at least, is what he will expect," said Lord Liverpool to Sir Walter, "and we would be perfectly justified in doing something more. What would you say to a viscountcy?" The reason that none of this ever happened was because, as Sir Walter pointed out, it was entirely impossible to bestow a title on Strange without doing something for Norrell, and somehow no one in the government liked Norrell well enough to wish to do it. The thought of having to address Mr. Norrell as Sir Gilbert or my lord was somehow rather depressing. Sleeping under a tree with only a rock for a pillow. At other times, I've seen thieves and beggars snoring upon feather beds in palace bedchambers. War is a very topsy-turvy business.
Well, I hope you will not find it dull in London.
The gentleman with the thistledown hair said that once you had tasted war, you were sure to be bored at home.
Ha! No, indeed. What, with everything clean and just so, and all one's books and possessions so close to hand,
and one's wife just before one, whenever one looks up.
What does, who did you say it was, the gentleman with what sort of hair?
A thistledown. I'm sure you must know the person I mean. He lives with Sir Walter and Lady Pole. At least I'm not sure he lives there, but I see him whenever I go to the house.
Strange frowned.
I do not know him. What is his name?
But Arabella did not know.
I've always supposed him to be a relation of Sir Walter or Lady Pole. How queer it is that I've never thought to ask him his name. I've had, hours of conversation with him.
Have you indeed? I'm not sure that I approve of that. Is he handsome?
Oh, yes, very. How odd that I do not know his name. He's very entertaining, quite unlike most people one meets.
And what do you talk of?
Oh, everything. But it always ends in him wishing to give me presents. On Monday last, he wanted to fetch me a tiger from Bengal. On Wednesday, he wished to bring me the Queen of Naples, because he said she and I are so much alike that we're sure to be the best of friends. And on Friday, he wished to send a servant to bring me a music tree.
A music tree?
Arabella laughed.
A music tree. He says that somewhere on a mountain with a storybook name, there grows a tree which bears sheet music instead of fruit, and the music is far superior to any other. I can never quite tell whether he believes his own tales or not. Indeed, there have been occasions when I've wondered if he's mad. I always make some excuse or other for not accepting his presents.
I'm glad.
I should not at all have cared to come home and find the house full of tigers and queens and music trees. Have you heard from Mr. Norrell recently?
Not recently, no.
Why are you smiling? Asked Strange.
Was I? I did not know.
Well, then I would tell you.
He once sent me a message, and that is all.
Once? In 3 years?
Yes. About a year ago, there was a rumor that you'd been killed at Vittoria, and Mr. Norrell sent Childermas to ask if it was true. I knew no more than he did. But that evening, Captain Moulthrop arrived. He had landed at Portsmouth not 2 days before, and had come straight here to tell me that there was not a word of truth in it. I shall never forget his kindness. Poor young man. His arm had been amputated only a month or so before, and he was still suffering very much. But there is a letter for you from Mr. Norrell on the table. Childermas brought it yesterday.
Strange got up and went to the table. He picked up the letter and turned it over in his hands. Well, I suppose I shall have to go, he said doubtfully. The truth was that he was not looking forward to meeting his old tutor with any very great enthusiasm. He'd become accustomed to independence of thought and action. In Spain, he had had his instructions from the Duke of Wellington, but what magic he did to fulfill those instructions had been entirely his own decision. Prospect of doing magic under Mr. Norrell's direction again was not an appealing one, and after months spent in the company of Wellington's bold, dashing young officers, the thought of long hours with only Mr. Norrell to talk to was a little grim. Yet, in spite of his misgivings, it was a very cordial meeting. Mr. Norrell was so delighted to see him, so full of questions about the precise nature of the spells he had employed in Spain, so full of praise for all that had been achieved, that Strange almost began to feel he had misjudged his tutor. Naturally enough, Mr. Norrell would not hear of Strange's giving up his role as Mr. Norrell's pupil.
No, 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 you must return here. We have a great deal to do. Now the war is over, all the real work is ahead of us. We must establish magic for the modern age. I have had the most gratifying assurances from several ministers who were anxious to assure me of the utter impossibility of their continuing to govern the country without the aid of our magic. And despite everything that you and I have done, there are misconceptions. Why, only the other day, I overheard Lord Castlereagh tell someone that you had, at the Duke of Wellington's insistence, employed black magic in Spain. I was swift to assure his lordship that you had employed nothing but the most modern methods.
Strange paused, and then inclined his head slightly in a manner which Mr. Norrell certainly took for acquiescence. But we were speaking of whether or not I should continue as your pupil. I have mastered all the sorts of magic on the list you made 4 years ago. You told me, sir, before I went to the peninsula, that you were entirely delighted with my progress, as I dare say you remember.
Oh, but that was barely a beginning. I have made another list while you were in Spain. I shall ring for Lucas to fetch it from the library. Besides, there are other books, you know, which I wish you to read.
He blinked his little blue eyes nervously at Strange. Strange hesitated. This was a reference to the library at Hertfew Abbey, which Strange had still not seen.
Oh, Mr. Strange, exclaimed Mr. Norrell. I'm very glad that you have come home, sir. I'm very glad to see you. I hope we may have many hours of conversation. Mr. Lascelles and Mr. Drawlight have been here a great deal.
Strange said he was sure of it.
But there's no talking to them about magic. Come back tomorrow. Come early. Come to breakfast.
Chapter 32. The King. November 1814. Early in November 1814, Mr. Norrell was honoured by a visit from some very noble gentlemen. An earl, a duke, and two baronets, who came, they said, to speak to him upon a matter of the utmost delicacy, and were so discreet themselves that half an hour after they had begun talking, Mr. Norrell was still entirely ignorant of what they wished him to do. It emerged that, elevated as these gentlemen were, they were the representatives of one still greater, the Duke of York, and they had come to speak to Mr. Norrell about the madness of the king. The king's sons had recently paid a visit to their father and had been very shocked by his sad condition. And though all of them were selfish and some of them were dissolute, and none of them was much given to making sacrifices of any sort, they had all told each other how they would give any amount of money and cut off any number of limbs to make the king a little more comfortable. But just as the king's children quarrelled amongst themselves as to which doctor their father should have, so they now quarrelled as to whether or not a magician should attend the king. Chief in opposition to the idea was the prince regent. Many years before, during the life of the great Mr. Pitt, the king had suffered a severe bout of madness, and the prince had ruled in his place. But then the king had recovered, and the prince had found his powers and privileges stripped away from him. Of all the tiresome situations in the world, thought the prince regent, the most tiresome was to rise from one's bed in a state of uncertainty as to whether or not one was the ruler of Great Britain. So perhaps the prince might be forgiven for wishing that the king remain mad, or at least only gain such relief as death would supply. Mr. Norrell, who had no wish to offend the prince regent, declined to offer his assistance, adding that he doubted very much whether the king's illness were susceptible of treatment by magic. So the king's second son, the Duke of York, who was a military gentleman, asked the Duke of Wellington if he thought that Mr. Strange might be persuaded to visit the king.
"Well, I'm certain of it," replied the Duke of Wellington. "Mr. Strange is always glad of an opportunity to do magic. Nothing pleases him more. The tasks I set him in Spain posed all sorts of difficulties, and though he made a great show of complaining, the truth was he could not have been more delighted. I have a great opinion of Mr. Strange's abilities. Spain is, as your Royal Highness knows, one of the most uncivilized places in the world, with scarcely any thoroughfare superior to a goat track from one end of the country to the other. But thanks to Mr. Strange, my men had good English roads to take them wherever they were needed. And if there was a mountain or a forest or a city in our way, why, Mr. Strange simply moved it somewhere else."
The Duke of York remarked that King Ferdinand of Spain had sent a letter to the Prince Regent complaining that many parts of his kingdom had been rendered entirely unrecognizable by the English magician, and demanding that Mr. Strange return and restore the country to its original form.
"Oh," said the Duke of Wellington, not much interested. "They're still complaining about that, are they?"
As a consequence of this conversation, Arabella Strange came downstairs one Thursday morning to find her drawing-room full of the king's male offspring. There were five of them, their Royal Highnesses, the Dukes of York, Clarence, Sussex, Kent, and Cambridge. They were all between 40 and 50 years of age. All had been handsome once, but all were rather fond of eating and drinking, and consequently all were growing rather stout. Mr. Strange was standing with his elbow on the mantelpiece, one of Mr. Norrell's books in his hand, and a polite look of interest upon his face, while their Royal Highnesses all talked at the same time and interrupted one another in their eagerness to describe the terrible pathos of the king's situation.
"Were you to see how His Majesty dribbles his bread and milk when he eats," said the Duke of Clarence to Arabella with tears in his eyes, "how full of imaginary fears he is, and how he holds long conversations with Mr. Pitt, who has been dead this age. Well, my dear, you could not help but be brought very low by the sight."
The Duke took Arabella's hand and began to stroke it, apparently under the impression that she was the parlour-maid. "All of His Majesty's subjects are very sorry that he's ill," said Arabella. "None of us can think of his suffering with indifference."
"Oh, my dear," cried the Duke, delighted. "How it touches my heart to hear you say so."
And he planted a large, wet royal kiss upon her hand and looked at her very tenderly. "If Mr. Norrell does not consider it a subject of capable treatment by magic, then frankly I do not think the chances are good," said Strange. "But I will gladly wait upon His Majesty."
"In that case," said the Duke of York, "there is only the problem of the Willises."
"And the Willises?" said Strange.
"Oh, indeed," cried the Duke of Cambridge. "The Willises are more impertinent than anyone can imagine." "We must be careful not to vex the Willises too much," warned the Duke of Clarence, "or they are sure to revenge themselves upon His Majesty." "The Willises will have a great many objections to Mr. Strange visiting the king," sighed the Duke of Kent.
The Willises were two brothers who owned a madhouse in Lincolnshire. For many years now they had attended the king whenever His Majesty had happened to become mad, and whenever he had happened to be in his right mind, the king had repeatedly told everyone how much he hated the Willises and how deeply he resented their cruel treatment of him. He had extracted promises from the queen and the dukes and the princesses that should he ever become mad again, they would not surrender him to the Willises. But it had done no good. At the first sign of delirium, the Willises had been sent for, and they had come immediately and locked the king in a room and clapped him in a strait waistcoat and given him strong, purging medicines.
I believe it will puzzle my readers, for it puzzled everyone else, that a king should be so little able to command his own fate. But consider with what alarm the rumour of madness is greeted in private families. Consider, then, how much greater alarm when the sufferer is the King of Great Britain. If you or I go mad, it is a misfortune for ourselves, our friends and family. When a king goes mad, it is a disaster for the whole nation. Frequently in the past, King George's illness had left it entirely uncertain who should govern the country. There were no precedents. No one had known what to do. It was not that the Willises were liked or respected. They were not. It was not that their treatments granted the king any relief from his torments. They did not. The secret of the Willises' success was that they were cool when everyone else was in a panic. They embraced a responsibility which everyone else was most anxious to avoid. In return, they demanded absolute control of the king's person. No one was permitted to speak to the king without a Willis being present. Not the queen, not the prime minister, not even the king's 13 sons and daughters. "Well," said Strange, when all this had been explained to him, "I admit that I would much rather speak to His Majesty without the encumbrance of other people, particularly people unfavourable to my purpose. However, I have upon occasion baffled the entire French army. I dare say I can manage two doctors. Leave the Willises to me." Strange refused to discuss the matter of a fee until he had seen the king. He would make no charge for visiting His Majesty, which the dukes, who all had gambling debts to pay and houses full of illegitimate children to feed and educate, thought very handsome of him. Early the next day, Strange rode out to Windsor Castle to see the king. It was a sharp, cold morning, and a thick white mist lay everywhere. On the way, he cast three small spells. The first ensured that the Willises would sleep long past their customary hour. The second spell caused the wives and servants of the Willises to forget to wake them. And the third made sure that when the Willises finally woke, none of their clothes or boots would be in the places where they had left them. 2 years earlier, Strange would have scrupled to play even so slight a trick as this upon two strangers. But now he did not give it a second thought. Like many other gentlemen who had been in Spain with the Duke of Wellington, he had begun unconsciously to imitate His Grace, part of whose character it was always to act in the most direct way possible. Footnote 1. In the life of Jonathan Strange, John Segundus discusses other ways in which he believes Strange's later actions were influenced by the Duke of Wellington. Towards 10 o'clock, he crossed the River Thames by the little wooden bridge at the village of Datchet. He passed along the lane between the river and the castle wall and entered the town of Windsor. At the castle gate, he told the sentry who he was and his business with the king. A servant in a blue uniform appeared to escort him to the king's apartments. The servant was a civil, intelligent sort of man, and as often happens with servants in grand places, he was excessively proud of the castle and everything to do with it. His chief pleasure in life lay in showing people around the castle and in fancying them astonished, awed, and amazed.
"Surely this cannot be your first visit to the castle, sir?" was his first question to Strange.
"Upon the contrary, I was never here in my life." The man looked shocked.
"Then, sir, you have missed one of the noblest sights that England has to offer."
"Indeed. Well, I am here now."
"But you are here on business, sir,"
answered the servant in a reproving tone,
"and will not, I dare say, have leisure to examine everything properly. You must come again, sir, in summer. And in case you should be a married gentleman, I take the liberty of observing that ladies are always particularly delighted with the castle."
He led Strange through a courtyard of impressive size. Long ago, in times of war, it must have provided a refuge for a large number of people and their livestock, and there were still a few ancient buildings in a very simple style that bore witness to the military character which the castle had originally possessed. But as time had gone on, the desire for kingly pomp and splendour had begun to outweigh more utilitarian considerations, and a magnificent church had been built which filled up most of the space. This church, called the chapel, but in truth more like a cathedral, displayed all the complexity and elaborateness of which the Gothic style is capable. It was hedged about with prickly stone buttresses, crowned with stone pinnacles, and it bulged with chapels, oratories, and vestries. The servant took Strange past a steep mound with smooth sides, surmounted by the round tower, which is the most easily recognizable part of the castle when viewed from a distance. Passing through a medieval gateway, they entered another courtyard. This was almost as magnificently proportioned as the first courtyard, but whereas the other had been peopled with servants, soldiers, and household officials, this was silent and empty.
"It is a great pity that you did not come here a few years ago, sir," said the servant. "At that time, it was possible to visit the King and Queen's apartments upon application to the housekeeper, but His Majesty's illness has made that impossible."
He led Strange to an imposing Gothic entrance in the middle of a long range of stone buildings. As they mounted a flight of stone stairs, he continued to bemoan the many obstacles which stood in the way of Strange's seeing the castle. He could not help but suppose Strange's disappointment to be very great.
"I have it," he declared suddenly. "I will show you St. George's Hall. Oh, it is not a hundredth part of what you ought to see, sir, but still it will give you a notion of the sublimity of which Windsor Castle is capable."
At the top of the stairs, he turned to the right and went swiftly through a hall with arrangements of swords and pistols upon the walls. Strange followed. They entered a long and lofty hall, some 200 or 300 feet long.
"There," said the servant,
with as much satisfaction as if he had built and decorated it himself. Tall arched windows along the south wall let in the cold, misty light. The lower part of the walls was panelled with pear wood, and the panels all had carved and gilded borders. The upper part of the walls and the ceiling were covered with paintings of gods and goddesses, kings and queens. The ceiling showed Charles II in the process of being carried up to eternal glory upon a white and blue cloud surrounded by fat pink cherubs. Generals and diplomats laid trophies at his feet, while Julius Caesar, Mars, Hercules, and various important personages stood about in some embarrassment, having been suddenly struck with a mortifying consciousness of their inferiority to the British king. All of this was most magnificent, but the painting which caught Strange's eye was a huge mural that stretched the entire length of the north wall. In the middle were two kings seated upon two thrones. On each side stood or knelt knights, ladies, courtiers, pages, gods, and goddesses. The left-hand part of the painting was steeped in sunlight. The king upon this side was a strong, handsome man who displayed all the vigour of youth. He was dressed in a pale robe, and his hair was golden and curling. There was a laurel wreath upon his brow and a scepter in his hand. The people and gods who attended him were all equipped with helmets, breastplates, spears, and swords, as if the artist wished to suggest that this king only attracted the most warlike of men and gods to be his friends. In the right-hand part of the painting, the light grew dim and dusky, as if the artist meant to depict a summer's twilight. Stars shone above and around the figures. The king on this side was pale-skinned and dark-haired. He wore a black robe, and his expression was unfathomable. He had a crown of dark ivy leaves, and in his left hand he held a slim ivory wand. His entourage was composed largely of magical creatures, a phoenix, a unicorn, a manticore, fauns and satyrs. But there were also some mysterious persons, a male figure in a monk-like robe with his hood pulled down over his face, a female figure in a dark starry mantle with her arm thrown over her eyes. Between the two thrones stood a young woman in a loose white robe with a golden helmet upon her head. The warlike king had placed his left hand protectively upon her shoulder. The Dark King held out his right hand towards her, and she had extended her hand to his so that their fingertips lightly touched.
"The work of Antonio Verrio, an Italian gentleman," said the servant.
He pointed to the king upon the left.
"That is Edward III of southern England."
He pointed to the king upon the right.
"And that is the magician king of northern England, John Usglas."
"Is it, though?" said Strange, greatly interested. "I have seen statues of him, of course, and engravings in books, but I do not think I ever saw a painting before. And the lady between the two kings, who is she?"
"That is Mrs. Gwynne, one of the mistresses of Charles II. She is meant to represent Britannia."
"I see. Well, it is something, I suppose, that he still has a place of honour in the king's house. But then they put him in Roman dress and make him hold hands with an actress. I wonder what he would say to that." The servant led Strange back through the weapon-lined room to a black door of imposing size, overtopped with a great jutting marble pediment.
"I take you no further than this, sir. My business ends here, and the Dr. Willis's begins. You will find the king behind that door."
He bowed and went back down the stairs. Strange knocked on the door. From somewhere inside came the sound of a harpsichord and someone singing. The door opened to reveal a tall, broad fellow of 30 or 40. His face was round, white, pockmarked, and bedabbled with sweat like a Cheshire cheese. All in all, he bore a striking resemblance to the man in the moon, who was reputed to be made of cheese. He had shaved himself with no very high degree of skill, and here and there on his white face two or three coarse black hairs appeared, rather as if a family of flies had drowned in the milk before the cheese was made, and their legs were poking out of it. His coat was of rough brown drugget, and his shirt and neckcloth were of the coarsest linen. None of his clothes were particularly clean. "Yes," he said, keeping his hand upon the door, as if he intended to shut it again at the least provocation. He had very little of the character of a palace servant, and a great deal of the character of a madhouse attendant, which was what he was. Strange raised his eyebrows at this rude behavior. He gave his name rather coldly, and said he had come to see the king. The man sighed. "Well, sir, I cannot deny that we were expecting you, but you see, you cannot come in. Dr. John and Dr. Robert," these were the names of the two Willis's brothers, "are not here. We've been expecting them every minute for the past hour and a half. We do not understand where they can have got to." "Well, that is most unfortunate," said Strange, "but it is none of my concern. I have no desire to see the gentleman you mention. My business is with the king. I have a letter signed by the Archbishops of Canterbury and York, granting me permission to visit His Majesty today." Strange waved the letter in the man's face.
"But you must wait, sir, until Dr. John and Dr. Robert come. They will not allow anyone to interfere with their system of managing the king. Silence and seclusion are what suits the king best. Conversation is the very worst thing for him. You can scarcely imagine, sir, what terrible harm you might do to the king merely by speaking to him. Say you were to mention that it's raining. I dare say you would consider that the most innocent remark in the world, but it might set the king a-thinking, you see, and in his madness his mind runs on from one thing to another, enraging him to a most dangerous degree. He might think of times in the past when it rained, and his servants brought him news of battles that were lost, and daughters that were dead, and sons that had disgraced him. Why, it might be enough to kill the king outright. Do you want to kill the king, sir?"
"No," said Strange.
"Well then," said the man coaxingly, "do you not see, sir, that it would be far better to wait for Dr. John and Dr. Robert?"
"Thank you, but I think I will take my chances. Conduct me to the king, if you please."
"Dr. John and Dr. Robert will be very angry," warned the man.
"I do not care if they are," replied Strange coolly. The man looked entirely astonished at this. "Now," said Strange, with a most determined look and another flourish of his letter, "will you let me see the king, or will you defy the authority of two archbishops? That is a very grave matter, punishable by, well, I do not exactly know what, but something rather severe, I should imagine." The man sighed. He called to another man, as rough and dirty as himself, and told him to go immediately to the houses of Dr. John and Dr. Robert to fetch them. Then, with great reluctance, he stood aside for Strange to enter. The proportions of the room were lofty. The walls were panelled in oak, and there was a great deal of fine carving. More royal and symbolic personages lounged about upon clouds on the ceiling. But it was a dreary place. There was no covering upon the floor, and it was very cold. A chair and a battered-looking harpsichord were the only furniture. An old man was seated at the harpsichord with his back to them. He was dressed in a dressing gown of ancient purple brocade. There was a crumpled nightcap of scarlet velvet on his head, and dirty, broken slippers on his feet. He was playing with great vigor and singing loudly in German. When he heard the sound of approaching footsteps, he stopped.
"Who's there?" he demanded. "Who is it?" "The magician, your majesty," said the madhouse attendant.
The old man seemed to consider this a moment, and then he said in a loud voice,
"It is a profession to which I have a particular dislike."
He struck the keys of his harpsichord again, and resumed his loud singing. And this was rather a discouraging beginning. The madhouse attendant gave an impertinent snigger and walked off, leaving Strange and the king alone. Strange took a few paces further into the room and placed himself where he might observe the king's face. It was a face in which all the misery of madness was compounded by the misery of blindness. The eyes had irises of clouded blue and whites as discolored as rotten milk.
Long locks of whitish hair, streaked with grey, hung down on either side of cheeks patched with broken veins. As the king sang, spittle flew from his slack red lips. His beard was almost as long and white as his hair. He was nothing at all like the pictures Strange had seen of him, for they had been made when he was in his right mind. With his long hair, long beard, and long purple robe, what he chiefly resembled was someone very tragic and ancient, out of Shakespeare, or rather, two very tragic and ancient persons out of Shakespeare. In his madness and his blindness, he was Lear and Gloucester combined. Strange had been cautioned by the royal dukes that it was contrary to court etiquette to speak to the king unless the king addressed him first. However, there seemed little hope of this, since the king disliked magicians so much. So when the king ceased his playing and singing again, he said, "I am your majesty's humble servant, Jonathan Strange, of Ashfair in Shropshire. I was magician in ordinary to the army during the late war in Spain, where, I'm happy to say, I was able to do your majesty some service. It is the hope of your majesty's sons and daughters that my magic might afford your majesty some relief from your illness."
"Tell the magician I do not see him," said the king airily.
Strange did not trouble to make any reply to this nonsensical remark. Of course the king could not see him. The king was blind.
"But I see his companion very well," continued his majesty in an approving tone.
He turned his head as though to gaze at a point 2 or 3 feet to the left of Strange.
"With such silver hair as he has got, I think I ought to be able to see him. He looks a very wild fellow."
So convincing was this speech that Strange actually turned to look. Of course, there was no one. In the past few days, he had searched Norrell's books for something pertinent to the king's condition. There were remarkably few spells for curing madness. Indeed, he had found only one, and even then he was not sure that was what it was meant for. It was a prescription in Ormskirk's Revelations of 36 Other Worlds. Ormskirk said that it would dispel illusions and correct wrong ideas. Strange took out the book and read through the spell again. It was a peculiarly obscure piece of magic, consisting only of the following words. "Place the moon at his eyes, and her whiteness shall devour the false sights the deceiver has placed there. Place a swarm of bees at his ears. Bees love truth and will destroy the deceiver's lies. Place salt in his mouth, lest the deceiver attempt to delight him with a taste of honey, or disgust him with a taste of ashes. Nail his hand with an iron nail, so that he shall not raise it to do the deceiver's bidding. Place his heart in a secret place, so that all his desires shall be his own, and the deceiver shall find no hold there." Memorandum. The color red may be found beneficial. However, as Strange read it through, he was forced to admit that he had not the least idea what it meant. Footnote 2. The likelihood was that neither did Ormskirk. He had simply written down a spell that someone else had told him, or that he had found in another book. And this is a perennial problem with the writings of the Argentine magicians. In their anxiety to preserve any scrap of magical knowledge, they were often obliged to set down what they themselves did not understand. How was the magician supposed to fetch the moon to the afflicted person? And if the second part was correct, then the dukes would have done better to employ a beekeeper instead of a magician. Nor could Strange believe that their royal highnesses would be best pleased if he began piercing the king's hands with iron nails. The note about the color red was odd, too. He thought he remembered hearing or reading something about red, but he could not at present recall what it was. The king, meanwhile, had fallen into conversation with the imaginary silver-haired person.
"I beg your pardon for mistaking you for a common person," he said. "You may be a king, just as you say, but I merely take the liberty of observing that I have never heard of any of your kingdoms. Where is Lost Hope? Where is the Blue Castles? Where is the City of Iron Angels? I, on the other hand, am King of Great Britain, place everyone knows, and which is clearly marked on all the maps."
His Majesty paused, presumably to attend to the silver-haired person's reply, for he suddenly cried out,
"Oh, do not be angry. Pray, do not be angry. You are a king, and I am a king. We shall all be kings together, and there is really no need for either of us to be angry. I shall play and sing for you."
He drew a flute from the pocket of his dressing gown and began to play a melancholy air. As an experiment, Strange reached forward and plucked off his majesty's scarlet nightcap. He watched closely to see if the king grew any more mad without it, but after several minutes of observation, he was forced to admit that he could see no difference. He put the nightcap back on. For the next hour and a half, he tried all the magic he could think of. He cast spells of remembering, spells of finding, spells of awakening, spells to concentrate the mind, spells to dispel nightmares and evil thoughts, spells to find patterns in chaos, spells to find a path when one was lost, spells of demystification, spells of discernment, spells to increase intelligence, spells to cure sickness, and spells to repair a limb that is shattered. Some of the spells were long and complicated. Some were a single word. Some had to be said out loud. Some had only to be thought. Some had no words at all, but consisted of a single gesture. Some were spells that Strange and Norrell had employed in some form or other every day for the last 5 years. Some had probably not been used for centuries. Some used a mirror, two used a tiny bead of blood from the magician's finger, and one used a candle and a piece of ribbon. But they all had this in common. They had no effect upon the king whatsoever. At the end of this time, oh, I give up, thought Strange. His Majesty, who had been happily unconscious of the magic directed at him, was chatting confidentially to the person with the silver hair that only he could see.
Have you been sent here forever, or can you go away again? Oh, do not stay to be caught. This is a bad place for kings. They put us in strait waistcoats. The last time I was permitted to go out of the rooms was on Monday in 1811. They tell me that was 3 years ago. But they lie. By my calculation, it will be 246 years on Saturday fortnight.
Oh, poor unhappy gentleman, thought Strange, shut away in this cold, melancholy place without friends or amusements. Small wonder time passes so slowly for him. Small wonder he is mad. Out loud he said, I shall be very happy to take you outside, Your Majesty, if you wish it. The king paused in his chatter and turned his head slightly.
Who said that?
He demanded.
I did, Your Majesty. Jonathan Strange, the magician.
Strange made the king a respectful bow before recollecting that His Majesty could not see it.
Great Britain! My dear kingdom! Cried the king. How I should love to see her again, especially now that it is summertime. The trees and meadows are all decked in their brightest finery, and the air is sweet as cherry tart.
Strange glanced out of the window at the white icy mist and the skeletal winter trees.
Quite so,
and I would account it a great honor if Your Majesty would accompany me outside. The king seemed to consider this proposal. He took off one of his slippers and attempted to balance it upon his head. When this did not work, he put the slipper back on, took a tassel that hung from the end of his dressing-gown cord, and sucked upon it thoughtfully.
But how do I know that you are not a wicked demon come to tempt me?
He asked at last, in a tone of the most complete reasonableness. Strange was somewhat lost for an answer to this question. While he was considering what to say, the king continued.
Of course, if you are a wicked demon, then you should know that I am eternal and cannot die. If I discover that you are my enemy, I shall stamp my foot and send you straight back to hell.
Really? Your Majesty must teach me the trick of that. I should like to know something so useful. But permit me to observe that with such powerful magic at your command, Your Majesty has nothing to fear from accompanying me outside. We should leave as quickly and discreetly as we can. The Willises are sure to be here soon. Your Majesty must be very quiet. The king said nothing, but he tapped his nose and looked very sly. The stranger's next task was to discover a way out without alerting the madhouse attendants. The king was no help at all in this regard. When asked where the various doors led to, he gave it as his opinion that one door led to America, another to everlasting perdition, and a third might possibly be the way to next Friday. So Strange picked one, the one the king thought led to America, and quickly escorted His Majesty through several rooms. All had painted ceilings in which English monarchs were depicted as dashing about the sky in fiery chariots, vanquishing persons who symbolized envy, sin, and sedition, and establishing temples of virtue, palaces of eternal justice, and other useful institutions of that sort. Though the ceilings were full of the most intense activity, the rooms beneath them were forlorn, threadbare, and full of dust and spiders. The furniture was all covered up with sheets, so that it appeared as if these chairs and tables must have died some time ago, and these were their gravestones. They came to a sort of back staircase. The king, who had taken Strange's warning to be quiet very much to heart, insisted upon tiptoeing down the stairs in the highly exaggerated manner of a small child. This took some time. "Well, Your Majesty," said Strange cheerfully when at last they reached the bottom, "I think we managed that rather well. I do not hear any sounds of pursuit. The Duke of Wellington would be glad to employ either of us as intelligence officers. I do not believe that Captain Somers Cox or Colhern Grant himself could have crossed enemy territory with more—" He was interrupted by the king playing a very loud, very triumphant blare upon his flute. "Damn," said Strange, and listened for sounds of the madhouse attendants coming, or worse still, the Willises. But nothing happened. Somewhere close at hand, there was an odd, irregular thumping and clattering, accompanied by screams and wailing, rather as if someone were being beaten by a whole cupboard full of brooms at once. Apart from that, all was quiet. A door opened onto a broad stone terrace. From here, the land descended steeply, and at the foot of the slope lay a park. On the right, a long double line of winter trees could be just seen. Arm in arm, the king and Strange walked along the terrace to the corner of the castle. Here Strange found a path leading down the slope and into the park. They descended this path, and had not walked far into the park when they came upon an ornamental pool bounded by a low stone rim. Footnote 3. This pool and the line of trees were all that remained of a vast ornamental garden planned by King William III, which had been begun but never completed. It had been abandoned when the cost proved far too great. The land had been allowed to return to its former state of park and meadow. At its centre stood a little stone pavilion decorated with carved creatures. Some resembled dogs, except that their bodies were long and low like lizards, and each had a row of spines along its back. Others were meant to represent curved stone dolphins, which had somehow contrived to fasten themselves to the walls. On the roof, half a dozen classical ladies and gentlemen were sitting in classical attitudes, holding vases. It had clearly been the architect's intention that fountains of water should gush out of the mouths of all these strange animals and out of the vases on the roof and tumble decoratively into the pool. But just now, all was frozen and silent. Strange was about to make some remark on the melancholy sight which this frozen pool presented, when he heard several shouts. He looked back and saw that a group of people was descending the slope of the castle very rapidly. As they drew nearer, he saw that there were four in number, two gentlemen he had never seen before, and the two madhouse attendants, the one with a face like a Cheshire cheese, and the one who had been sent to fetch the Willises. They all looked angry. The gentlemen hurried up, frowning in an important, offended sort of manner. They showed every symptom of having dressed in a great hurry. One was attempting to fasten the buttons of his coat, but without much success. As soon as he did up the buttons, they flew open again. He was about Mr. Norrell's age, and wore an old-fashioned wig, rather like Mr. Norrell's, which from time to time made a little jump and spun round on his head. But he differed from Mr. Norrell in that he was rather tall, rather handsome, and had an imposing, decisive manner. The other gentleman, who was several years younger, was plagued by his boots, which seemed to have developed opinions of their own. While he was struggling to walk forwards, they were attempting to carry him off in an entirely different direction. Strange could only suppose that his earlier magic had been rather more successful than he'd expected, and had made the clothes themselves difficult to manage. The tallest gentleman, the one who wore the playful wig, gave Strange a furious stare. "Upon whose authority is the king outside?" he demanded. Strange shrugged. "Mine, I suppose." "You? Who are you?" Not liking the manner in which he was addressed, Strange retorted. "Who are you?"
"I am Dr. John Willis. This is my brother, Dr. Robert Darling Willis. We are the king's physicians. We have charge of the king's person by order of the Queen's Council. No one is allowed to see his majesty without our permission. I ask you again, who are you?"
"I am Jonathan Strange. I have come at the request of their royal highnesses, the Dukes of York, Clarence, Sussex, Kent, and Cambridge, to see whether or not his majesty might be cured by magic."
"Ha!" cried Dr. John contemptuously. "Magic! That is chiefly used for killing Frenchmen,
is it not? Dr. Robert laughed in a sarcastic manner, but the effect of cold scientific disdain was rather spoilt when his boots suddenly carried him off with such force that he banged his nose against a tree.
Well, magician, said Dr. John, you mistake your man if you think you may mistreat me and my servants with impunity. You will admit, I dare say, that you glued the doors of the castle shut by magic, so that my men could not prevent you leaving.
Certainly not, declared Strange. I did nothing of the sort. I might have done it, he conceded, if there had been any need. But your men are as idle as they are impertinent. When His Majesty and I left the castle, they were nowhere to be seen. The first madhouse attendant, the one with a face like a Cheshire cheese, almost exploded upon hearing this.
That's not true, he cried. Dr. John, Dr. Robert, I beg that you will not listen to these lies. Martin here, he indicated the other madhouse attendant, has had his voice entirely taken from him. He cannot make a sound to raise the alarm.
The other madhouse attendant mouthed and gestured furiously in confirmation.
As for me, sir, I was in the passageway at the bottom of the stairs when the door opened at the top. I was just readying myself to speak to this magician, and some strong words I was going to give him too, sir, on your behalf, when I was pulled by magic into a broom cupboard, and the door shut fast upon me.
What nonsense, cried Strange.
Nonsense, is it? Cried the man. And I suppose you did not make the brooms in the cupboard beat me. I'm all over bruises.
This at least was perfectly true. His face and hands were covered in red marks.
There, magician, cried Dr. John triumphantly. What do you say now that all your tricks are exposed?
Oh, really? Said Strange. He has done that to himself to make his story more convincing. The king blew a vulgar noise on his flute.
Be assured, said Dr. John, that the Queen's Council will soon hear of your impudence.
And then, turning away from Strange, he cried out,
Your Majesty, come here.
The king skipped nimbly behind Strange.
You will oblige me by returning the king to my care, said Dr. John.
I will do no such thing, declared Strange.
And you know how lunatics should be treated, do you? Said Dr. Robert with a sneer. You have studied the matter.
I know that to keep a man without companionship, to deny him exercise and a change of air, cannot possibly cure anything, said Strange.
It is barbaric. I would not keep a dog so.
In speaking as you do, added Dr. Robert, you merely betray your ignorance. The solitude and tranquillity of which you complain so vigorously are the cornerstones of our whole system of treating the king.
Oh, said Strange, you call it a system, do you? And what does it consist of, this system?
There are three main principles, declared Dr. Robert. Intimidation.
The king played a few sad notes upon his flute.
Isolation,
which became a lonely little tune.
And restraint,
ending in a long note like a sigh.
In this way, continued Dr. Robert, all possible sources of excitement are suppressed, and the patient is denied material with which to construct his fantasies and improper notions.
But in the end, added Dr. John, it is by the imposition of his will upon his patient that the doctor effects his cure. It is the forcefulness of the doctor's own character which determines his success or failure. It was observed by many people that our father could subdue lunatics merely by fixing them with his eye.
Really? Said Strange, becoming interested in spite of himself. I had never thought of it before, but something of the sort is certainly true of magic. There are all sorts of occasions when the success of a piece of magic depends upon the forcefulness of the magician's character.
Indeed,
said Dr. John, glancing briefly to his left. Yes. Take Martin Pale, for example. Now he... Strange's eyes involuntarily followed where Dr. John had looked. One of the madhouse attendants, the one who could not speak, was creeping around the ornamental pool towards the king with a pale-colored something in his hands. Strange could not think at first what it could be, and then he recognized it. It was a straight waistcoat. Several things happened at once. Strange shouted something. He did not know what. The other madhouse attendant lunged towards the king. Both Willises attempted to grab Strange. The king blew piercing shrieks of alarm on his flute, and there was an odd noise as if 100 or so people had all cleared their throats at once. Everyone stopped and looked about them. The sound appeared to have come from the little stone pavilion at the center of the frozen pool. Suddenly, out of the mouths of each stone creature, a dense white cloud appeared,
as if they had all exhaled at once. The breath clouds glittered and sparkled in the thin, misty light, and then fell upon the ice with a faint tinkling sound. There was a silence, followed immediately by a horrible sound like blocks of marble being ripped apart. Then the stone creatures tore themselves from the walls of the pavilion and began to crawl and waddle down and across the ice towards the Willises. Their blank stone eyes rolled in their sockets. They opened their stone mouths, and from every stone throat came a plume of water. Stone tails snaked from side to side, and stone legs went stiffly up and down. The lead pipes, which conducted water to their mouths, extended magically behind them. The Willises and the madhouse attendants stared, quite unable to comprehend what was happening. The grotesque creatures crawled, dragging their pipes behind them and dousing the Willises with water. The Willises shrieked and leapt about, more from fright than because of any real hurt they had sustained. The madhouse attendants ran away, and as to the Willises remaining any longer with the king, there could be no question of it. In the cold air, their drenched clothes were turning icy. "Magician!" cried Dr. John as he turned to run back to the castle. "Why? It is just another name for liar. Lord Liverpool shall know of it, magician. He shall know how you use the king's physicians." "Ow! Ow!" He would have said more, but the stone figures on the roof of the pavilion had stood up and begun pelting him with stones. Strange merely bestowed a contemptuous smile on both Willises. But he was acting more confident than he felt. The truth was, he was beginning to feel decidedly uncomfortable. Whatever magic had just been done had not been done by him.
Chapter 33. Place the Moon at My Eyes. November 1814. It was most mysterious. Could someone in the castle be a magician? One of the servants, perhaps, or one of the princesses? It did not seem likely. Could it be Mr. Norrell's doing? Strange pictured his tutor, sitting in his little room upon the second floor at Hanover Square, peering into his silver dish, watching all that had happened, and finally driving away the Willises with magic. It was possible, he supposed. Bringing statues to life was, after all, something of a speciality of Mr. Norrell's. It had been the first magic to bring him to the public notice. And yet, why would Mr. Norrell suddenly decide to help him? Out of the kindness of his heart? Hardly. Besides, there had been a dark humor in the magic, which was not like Norrell at all. The magician had not merely wanted to frighten the Willises. He had wanted to make them ridiculous. No, it could not be Norrell. But who, then? The king did not seem in the least fatigued. In fact, he was more inclined to dance and skip about and generally rejoice over the defeat of the Willises. So, thinking that further exercise would certainly do His Majesty no harm, Strange walked on. The white mist had erased all detail and color from the landscape and left it ghostly. Earth and sky were blended together in the same insubstantial gray element.